This episode of Guitar Radio Show is brought to you in part by...
With a unique design and construction, DNA Guitars is a clear choice when looking for the all-around guitar. DNA Guitars' recipe for creating perfect instruments is steeped in tradition while looking toward the future. DNA's recessed bridge construction is a five-point contact bridge, a solid brass bridge that is inset into the body, maximizing strength, contact, and string vibration. An incredibly comfortable guitar to play, DNA Guitars molds to your body, and the neck profiles are wonderful to play across. DNA uses an exclusive 100% solderless wiring harness that is designed for guitars with single coil or humbucker setup. Looking for versatility? Look no more. Check out DNA Guitars. Go to dnaguitarcompany.com. Custom guitars handcrafted in the USA. DNA Guitars. Innovation to fuel your inspiration.
And also by...
Hey everybody, Mark Davin from Guitar Radio Show. Have you heard about Lock Knob? LockKnob.com? Lock Knob is a revolutionary product invented by a musician for musicians, solving the long-time problem of lost settings. How many times have you been at a gig or a session only to have to reset all of your settings on your amp or your pedals because they move during transit? You can upgrade your existing knobs on your amp, pedals, mixer, guitar, almost anything with a pot, with an all-aluminum quality made reusable knob that does more than just look pretty. Never lose your settings again. Lock it down with Lock Knob. Go to LockKnob.com for more.
Welcome to Guitar Radio Show, the show dedicated to the guitar player, guitar maker, gear builder, and purveyors of such items that you may not know about, but should. Here's your host, Mark Davin.
Hey everybody, welcome to episode 150. Of Guitar Radio Show 150, and we've got the great Rick Emmett on the show today. I'm so excited about this because this is somebody that I wanted to talk to for a long, long time, and we were finally able to make it happen. He has a new record out. It's called Resolution 9, or Res 9, if you will, and this is a rocking album, man. He, I tell you, there's not a whole lot that this cat can't do. Obviously, a lot of folks remember him from Triumph, but what he did after that was pretty incredible. I mean, he delved off into so many different directions that were absolutely wonderful and really just fantastic guitar centric stuff, and I really appreciate that. So we're going to be talking to him today. Super excited about that. Hey folks, want to remind you, guitarradioshow.com. for all your burning needs. Also, if you have any questions, you can go to guitarradioshow@gmail.com. And don't forget about the giveaway. You've got till November 1st, 2016, to win that Checkered Pedals phaser. And you go to guitarradioshow@gmail.com, and in the subject line, put in, "Give me that pedal," and you're automatically entered to win that phase pedal. Also want to remind you, November's coming up, and we've got some really cool stuff coming up in regards to all the great guests coming up. We've got Von York Strings, we've got Vinnie Smith from VPix, a whole bunch of cool folks. Johnny Hyland's coming back to say hey. And we've got some really cool new information from one of our sponsors, DNA Guitars. Go to dnaguitarcompany.com and just kind of stroll around over there. Got some really cool and really exciting news coming from them for the month of November, and we're super excited to be involved. In the meantime, what do you say we get started with our interview with Mr. Rick Emmett? You ready? Guitar Radio Show, guitarradioshow.com.
Fire of a dragon light. right, people. Well, whether it's the blazing guitar work on Triumph's I Live for the Weekend, holy crap, that's an amazing guitar part on that song, right on to his acoustic trio disc that I absolutely love. It's called Trifecta. Rick Emmett is the consummate musician and guitarist, and we're thrilled to have to talk to him today. Rick, welcome to Guitar Radio Show. How are you?
I'm good, thank you, Mark. It's nice to be able to chat with you.
Oh, I appreciate it. How's things? You're in Toronto, right?
Well, I live in a western suburb called Burlington. I lived in Mississauga, which was a western suburb for, 38 years, and my wife and I downsized and moved last summer, so I'm a little further west, but it's part of the GTA. Toronto has kind of grown to the point where, much like every urban center, it's connected to other urban centers that used to be 30, 40 miles away, and now it just kind of sprawls all the way around Lake Ontario. Now they call it the Golden Horseshoe, and so I'm sort of moving up towards the top of the horseshoe.
Yeah. Well, that's happening here in Austin, too. I mean, someone said to me the other day, at some point, we're not going to know to be able to differentiate between Austin and San Antonio. It's becoming that.
I remember doing those drives back in the day, too. And, I can certainly see how that would happen. You'd just be driving along the highway, and, instead of a gas station or something, it's a restaurant, and then there's a hotel, and then there's a this, and then there's a that, and then before you know it, you're in the other town.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And, those Denny's just start to blend into each other.
Yeah.
As I was preparing for this interview, I was thinking, in everything you've ever done, there's always been this feeling that exudes from what you do, whether it be the music or... I used to read your column in GP religiously every month. There's always been this feeling of positivity. You're pragmatic, but you're very positive. Is this who you are? Is that a part of your code, if you will?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not like that all the time, but I think in terms of, when you're in show business, when you're in the music business, which is a very small part of show business, but, it's show business, you're in the business of showing people stuff. And so, what exactly do you decide, you want to show? If you were an actor, what roles would you choose? And then what parts of the characters that you're involved in would you decide you want, you think is important to show in the context of whatever play or movie or thing you're in? So in music, it's a little bit more metaphorical than all of that, because but you're still inhabiting some kind of a public persona. And I've always felt like, in terms of what I had to offer, and I don't want to... I teach at a college level, and one time the guy that runs the program there said to me in conversation, Rick, you're probably one of the most pedantic people I've ever met. And to which, I raised my eyebrows and felt like I'd been insulted. And he said, I don't mean that in a negative way. He says, I mean that in the most straightforward kind of way. Pedantic isn't necessarily a negative word. It's go ahead and look it up, kind of thing. So, and I think it's probably true that I a little bit pedantic, a little didactic. Like, I was probably born to be a teacher in certain ways, or to be a coach, or, those kinds of things are part of my character. So, now I'm making music, and it brings whatever opportunities it brings, writing in Guitar Player Magazine, or, doing clinics and workshops, and, you look around yourself at other people in the music business, and what do they do? Well, some people, it's very much a kind of an exploitation. They're going to, commercial transaction, they're going to try and make money by, making a big deal out of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's perfectly legit, but did it feel right in my bones? I kind of felt like, no, you write a song, you want to try and I tell students all the time, you know, you're going to play a gig, somebody's going to buy a ticket. You got to give them their money's worth. Like, that's part of the show. Like, you're definitely going to have to do stuff to try and give people their money's worth, entertain them and make the show larger than life. But you also have a responsibility to the art that you have, to the music that you make, to the gifts that you possess. And that responsibility is to try and give something people that money can't buy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what makes it become really special. That's what makes fans become loyal to you, that you've offered them something that money can't buy. You've kind of gone the extra distance. So, again, you know, is this my character? Is this something that I decided professionally through the course of doing these? It's probably combinations of those things, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I just tend to be someone that goes, well, you know, this is what I'll offer. Now, positivity, do I live it and breathe it 24 hours a day? No, sir. You know, I have my dark places, and I have my grief and my sorrow and my sadnesses, and you know, I have days where I'm thinking, man, I'm not sure which way is up.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's only, you know, human. I think it's, you know, no one is 100% consistent, you know, all
mm-hmm.
the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a question of what I'm choosing to try. And I mean, another answer to this question, and I'm sorry to ramble. Well, the first question you asked, and I talk for an hour.
No, that's good. That's good.
But, you know, why did I end up in a band called Triumph? You know,
yeah.
I didn't name it. You know, the guys, Mike and Gil, had the name for the band before I joined. But that's, it only sort of reinforced what I was going to, you know, now I'm in this band that's got a name. Well, you got to live up to that name. So it seemed a natural thing to write songs about holding on to your dreams and fighting good fights
right.
and never surrendering and, you know, all that stuff.
Yeah. Well, that's what you just said really to me translates also from positivity also to honesty. And that comes out too. I think when you are honest about what you do, and you're kind of splaying yourself open in many respects. I mean, that's what it's like when you go out there and perform. I was a performer for years, and it was like, you know, you left that old saying of leaving it all on the stage. You know,
yeah
you do. You there's nothing but, you know, there were nights I thought I was going to just turn to dust.
Wouldn't want to turn people into dust.
No, I mean myself.
Yeah, no, I know. You know, I'm a big believer in that, and I think maybe part of that too is just when I was a kid, and you know, you first practice to deceive, and then you start to realize, yeah, I'm not very good at this. You know, I feel bad when I do it, and everybody can see right through me. You know, so maybe honesty will be the best policy.
Yeah.
You know? But I think it's true that you know, you wouldn't have to look far in my lyrics to find songs that are saying, "Hey, look, just be honest with me, just be truthful." You know,
mm-hmm.
like let's just be real here. You know,
mm-hmm.
And certainly when it comes to making music, I feel like the best music is the kind, you know. And there's an old saying, something about you know. There's only two types of music, good and bad, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then I guess everybody makes that subjective decision for themselves, you know. But
mm-hmm.
for me, you know, bad music is full of artifice, you know. And good music is, it's really pretty clear what the composer or the performer is emotionally, intellectually trying to achieve, you know, that they've found a way to make themselves become articulate in what it is that they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I go, well, that's good. You know, and I, again, you know, I come back to things. A couple of years ago, there was that Bruno Mars song that was just so incredibly infectious. I'm mm-hmm. trying to remember the title of it now. It was like a funky thing.
Oh, yeah, I know which one you're talking about. The one with Mark...
Mark Ronson was
that's it. Mark Ronson, that's it.
Yeah, yeah. So it was, you know, I don't know, Get Me to Funky Town or something.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah. It was great. Yeah,
it stole every good funky lick from the course of history.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, created this just unbelievably infectious song. And in my songwriting class in the college, I would tell the students, you know, my 3-year-old grandson, when his father plays that on his phone, he'll get up and he'll do the dance moves from the video, and he'll do all that. Stop! Wait a minute! And he starts dancing around and doing the thing, and like, so that music communicated directly to a 3-year-old, mm-hmm. you know, and it also works to grandparents. You know, it also works to people that are in old age homes. Mm-hmm. They hear that song, and they can't help it. That music makes them feel good. So that guy totally accomplished what he set out to do when they made that recording. And I think honesty is the thing that makes it so that it speaks universally, mm-hmm. you know. I think that's pretty important. If you're making music, you're kind of sort of reaching for that universal thing. How can you push that button in people?
Right. Well, yeah, and then first it has to make you feel good, and chances are if it makes you feel good, it'll make somebody else feel good too.
Or sad, you know, or bluesy.
Yeah,
you know,
whatever you're looking for, yeah.
Yeah. Again, it's sort of, it's that emotional button that you're trying to, you know. I mean, I don't know how it works, but there's books, like there's a guy named Levitin out of Montreal, McGill University. He's a brain researcher, and he's written books like This Is Your Brain on Music, and mm-hmm. The World and Songs. I think it's Daniel, I think is his first name, Levitin. And there's just recently been stuff in the paper where, you know, his pal Sting comes by and, you know, they run scans on Sting's brain while he's listening to music, you know, and they're finding stuff out about how it, you know, it goes into your ear and it gets into your brain, and then what does it do? You know, how is it that it's working and making you feel the way you feel? Mm-hmm. It's still a bit of a mystery, but they're finding out more and more all the time.
Yeah.
But you know, how is it that an earworm becomes an earworm so that, you know, you're walking around and you go, damn, I can't get that lick out of my head. You know, like, I think that's the very human part of it, that, you know, our physiology, the way our brains are wired, you know, there's certain things that it just works, you know. Mm-hmm. And I guess, you know, some of us are wired differently than others, but there are things that are, they're shared, you know, they're common. And, mm-hmm. It's not like I look for low common denominators all the time, but, you know, to come back to where your question was at, you know, I try to reach for ones where I feel like this might make people's day a little bit better. It might make their lives, you know, it might enhance their lives a little bit, you know. Mm-hmm. Yes, certainly, to allude to something you said, do I do it for my own benefit? Absolutely. You know, do I need to hear a good song from time to time? Do I need music to make me feel better? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, yeah, I definitely do sort of try to please myself first, and then I worry about an audience. But, you know, in the end, when it comes down to choosing which songs make it to the album, you know, you sit there and you look at the pile of stuff and you go, okay, you know, I think these are the ones that are less self-indulgent. Like, if a song is too self-indulgent, it won't make the cut for me. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I don't do it just for myself. I try to meet an audience straight on, like, back to that thing you said about honesty, you know. So, you know, that's a 50-50 kind of thing. You know, it's got to mean something to me, obviously, but I really want it to speak to an audience and work for an audience. I'm not completely self-indulgent.
Mm-hmm. And it's what's interesting about you, too, is that you... I've noticed over the years that when I hear you play, whether it would have been with Triumph or any of the other stuff you've done, you know, whether it be the work on Handiwork or and then Marco's Secret Songbook or Trifecta, 10 Invitations, whatever it is that you were doing, and it was really hard to label. It was really hard to pigeonhole you or categorize you. Is that because, I mean, because for me, I look at music as a buffet table. You know, is that what it's like for you as well?
Sure. You know, that metaphor will work. I mean, I tend to sort of just go back to what I said about good and bad earlier. Like, you know, I think I was fortunate that, you know, my life and my career in music started at a time when pop music, rock music was pretty damn eclectic. FM radio was blossoming, and it was about albums instead of singles, and so that allowed bands to be, you know, a lot more eclectic. I liked progressive bands, and progressive bands actually had a pretty good market share. They were doing okay, you know. And of course, I was a musician studying music. I loved jazz, and I loved classical music, and I loved, you know, I sang in the church choir when I was a kid. Like, I had, when I was in high school, I would play Thursday nights. The YMCA had a coffee house, and that was a kind of a holdover from the early 60s when there were coffee houses, and all that was the thing, and it was all folk music. And I loved folk music, and I was, you know, a part of me, I was styling it after Paul Simon songs and James Taylor songs, and you know, but you could watch Hee Haw on TV and see Roy Clark, and he would play Malaguena on an electric guitar, and that's a fairly eclectic thing that on a country music show you're seeing the guy play Spanish, you know what I mean? Like, but that was the world, that was what was going on at the time. You know, then Stairway to Heaven would be on FM radio, and you know, there's a song that goes from being a kind of a folky ballad to being this, you know, epic. You know, so those were my influences, and, you know, I just never decided, okay, I'm going to specialize, you know, and yeah, I had to do an interview yesterday for a guitar thing, and as part of answering a question, I said to the guy, you know, I think some guys, you know, guitar players, as they're growing up and maturing and turning from a, you know, a teenager into an adult, they focus in and they go, okay, if I want to find work, if I'm going to make a living here, I got to specialize. I got to find a style, and I got to get really good at that one style and build a reputation, make a name for myself in that style. But for me, I got work from, you know, right from the get-go when I was in high school because I could sing. That was part, I was a guitar player who could sing, and I wrote my own songs. And so it was like, whoa, well, hang on for a second. This guy, he's more like a triple threat, you know. So because of that, I think it made me much more eclectic in my own nature. And then, so I land a gig in Triumph, and, you know, Triumph is always, every album, incredibly desperate for material because it wasn't like the other guys in the band were very conscientious writers. So it was like, oh, what are we going to do? You know, and then, well, you know, I could throw a classical guitar piece onto this, you know, onto side B here. These two songs are in the same key. And the guys would go, oh, brilliant. Okay, great. Yeah, let's do that. So Triumph afforded me the opportunity to have my reputation build, where at 1 minute in the band I'm playing, you know, as you mentioned earlier, I Live for the Weekend, where I'm just blowing my socks off.
Yeah.
And, you know, then the next second I'm playing, you know, some sort of a small prelude or a minuet on a classical guitar. And then people go, whoa, look at this guy. Wow, he's so eclectic. You know, and I'm going, well, I'm just doing what I was doing when I was 14 and I was no good at it. You know?
Yeah, all right. That makes sense. Can you recall the moment that you said, "Oh, as a child, oh, I want to play guitar."
Oh, well, you know, I mean, I'm a product of the age when the Beatles played at Sullivan, you know. I think I was maybe 11 years old, you know, 1964. But, you know, we were already playing Beatles 45s on a Seabreeze record player in my neighbor's garage and strumming tennis rackets. So we were playing a game where we pretended to be the Beatles.
Right.
So, for sure, that was a big part of it, that whole Mersey British invasion thing happened. And in Canada, it was maybe even a little bit bigger and a little bit more premature here than it was in the United States, because the president of Capitol Records Canada was at the time was a guy named White. I think his first name was Ron, but I'm not sure. Hey, what was the president of Capitol's first name, White? Vice president?
Steve.
Oh, yeah, but who was the guy White that was the A&R guy? That ran the office down there on... Okay, my wife doesn't remember either. She worked for Capitol for a while. Anyways, that guy, when he'd heard the acetates from Parlophone of the Beatles' first record, he, you know, said to the company, "No, we got to put this out. This is going to be huge." And you know, nobody else in the label here in Canada knew or understood or cared, but they went, "Yeah, okay." So, you know, they put it out, and that was before the Americans had decided to release it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it kind of, it happened here a little sooner, maybe 6 months, 8 months. And that guy, he was able, his whole career, he was able to, you know, ride on the coattails of that. Because in the end, for example, when EMI was searching the world, trying to find the best quality masters that existed, Canada had a lot of them because that guy had treated the Beatles like a priority right from the get-go. And, you know, nobody else really had the foresight of that. So, anyways, that's a roundabout, you know, off the slight tangent there. But, yeah, I would trace it back to that era. My family, we didn't have enough dough that we had a piano in the house, but my grandfather brought a guitar that had been in his sister's closet. So my dad's aunt had a plywood, one of those sort of catalog specials. You know, it had palm trees and hula dancers stenciled on the front.
Mm-hmm.
The strings were like telephone cable, you know, slice your hands up. But that was my first guitar, and that was right around that same time. And
so you were learning cowboy chords and stuff like that.
Yeah, in fact, you know, when I first started, I wanted to play left-handed, like, you know, and play the other way around like McCartney.
Mm-hmm.
And I won 8 free lessons from the Regency School of Music in Toronto, West End Toronto. And that was just a gaffe where they were just trying to rope in kids from the local schoolyards and get them to come. And, you know, then you'd come and you'd have your 8 free lessons. And then they would say, "Oh, Mr. and Mrs. Emmett, your son is... he's so talented. He's so gifted. Like, you should be signing him up. And, you know, here's the type of guitar he should be playing." You know, it was like a little racket they had running. But nevertheless, that wrote me. And I think it was in grade 7, you know. So, and they actually, I can't remember the exact process of it, but there was slide guitar. It was like lap. And you learned that way first.
Hmm.
And then, okay, now you could prop it up on your lap, and you could and you could play it the right way, and, you know, Mel Bay Book 1 kind of thing.
Sure,
you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah. And I had this guy who was a teacher. His name was Jack Arsenault, and Jack was a left-handed guy who played right-handed. And I was saying, "No, man, I want to play this way. I want to play with my right hand on the fretboard." And he said, "No, you don't want to do that, man." He said, "Turn it around and put your left hand on the fretboard." I go, "Oh, no, this feels really weird." He goes, "Look, you just trust me. Give me a month, and I promise you, you will be a better guitar player than all your right-handed friends." And I went, "Okay." And it was true because, of course, my left hand was my strong hand, and it became easier for me to do things like bar chords and stuff. I was way ahead of the right-handed guys who were struggling mightily, you know, And I had this, you know, I'm not ambidextrous, but I'm sort of dextrosinistral, which means I do things of strength with my left hand. I would hammer a nail with my left hand.
Mm-hmm.
But when I pick up a pen and write, I would write with my right hand.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, it's kind of like I was born to be a guitar player. Like, there's lots of guys like me, Richie Blackmore, Steve Morse. I think Eddie Van Halen is probably Dextro Sinistro.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, you know, we play right-handed, but we're actually sort of left-headed, right-brained, left-headed kind of guys.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's interesting. I'm a left-handed guitar player, so I can understand that. Cause like,
well, there you go.
For me,
if you only had Jack Arsenal when you were 11 years old.
Yeah, if only. You know, I mean, I throw a ball with my right hand. I can hammer a nail with either my left or my right. So it's, you know, whatever. It's weird.
But, well, that's you're almost ambidextrous. Could you write with either hand?
No, I can't.
Okay. No. Wait, so you write with which one?
The left hand.
Okay. Yeah, so you're sinistro-dextral.
Hmm.
Yeah. And my daughter is a little bit, my first daughter, she's a little bit like that, but she's mostly purely left-handed. Writes with her left hand, mm-hmm. hammers with her left hand, kicks with her left foot.
Huh. Yeah. I use scissors with my right hand.
Yeah. Ah, well, see, you got a little tiny bit of ambidextrosity.
Yeah, it's interesting. So you've got a new record coming.
Yeah.
And
it's called Res 9. RES9,
uh-huh.
And it's billed as Rick Emmett and Resolution 9. The name of my band now is Resolution 9.
Okay.
And there's a bit of a gaffe there because it's R-E, capital R-E, which is my initials, and the S is the capital of Solution. So it's sort of the Rick Emmett Solution, number 9.
Okay.
You know? Yeah, and it's a real rock record. It's a band record. Mascot label group out of Rotterdam.
Oh.
So it'll be on their Pro Vogue label. So
very
that's a label
cool.
that has like Steve Lukather and Robin Ford and
yeah.
Joe Bonamassa and, you know, Warren Haynes. And like there's a lot of great,
yeah.
great guitar players. So I was very honored that they offered me a deal. You know, at 62 years of age, I'm like, you got to be kidding me. Is this going to happen? A major deal?
Yeah, I've had a lot of the mascot people on the show, and it's been a blast. I mean, what they're doing right now is, I think they're trying to create a new revolution, if you will, of a new resurgence or whatever it might be of these great, great guitar players doing really accessible music.
Yeah.
And it's great because I know the Europeans are eating it up with a spoon. They love it. And all the European audience I have, they are always giving me feedback of how much they love like Supersonic Blues Machine and, you know, some of the other artists that are on Mascot. And it's Monster Truck.
Yeah,
Monster Truck. Gary Hoey, you know, people like that. So.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
well, you know, I mean, you got to credit Ed Van Ziel. He's the guy, and I think it's his money or his family's money,
uh-huh.
you know. And the thing that I just found unbelievably wonderful is that, you know, I'm on the phone with him saying, okay, so, you know, what is it you expect from me? And he goes, I expect you to give me your best. And I go, well, that's kind of vague. Like, stylistically, what is it? And he goes, look, this is what I want. I want you to go into the studio, and I want you to make a record that when you're talking to the media, you can say, I made exactly the record that I wanted to make, and the record company didn't get in the way, and they didn't fuck it up. Like, you know, he goes, I want you to be able to say nice things about the label. I want you to be able to say nice things about the process. I just want to make it easy for you to do your best work. And I went,
wow.
Oh, my God. This
wow.
is, yeah, can you imagine patronage that is so benign?
That's
it
amazing.
It was beautiful.
Yeah.
I was like, this is incredible. I mean, I for sure, Mozart never had it so good. You know, like, if you were Haydn, you had to wear the servant's livery. You know, you were bought and owned. You were like the slave. You were like the upstairs maid. And this guy, you know, it just makes it so that he's really respecting what the artistic process can be. So it was great. I mean, I knew that he wanted lots of guitar playing. You know, obviously that there's a the nature of the label is such that you go, well, okay, you know, I guess there better be some stuff here where I blow my brains out a little bit, mm-hmm, you know. But I don't know. I mean, what I shot for was a singer-songwriter record that was all about realizing the songs by playing, you know, some fairly hefty testosterone-y kind of guitar, you know. Mm-hmm. Not all the time, but most of the time. And the budget was good enough that I was able to get Alex Lifeson of Rush to come in and play on a couple of tracks.
Wow.
James LaBrie of Dream Theater to sing on a couple of things.
Wow.
There's a Triumph reunion on one track. Well, Gil and Mike got their stuff out of mothballs, and I got them in the studio, too, at Metalworks, and they played on a track for me. So, you know, there's a lot of things about the record that, you know, they make me very happy, very proud, you know, and, you know, totally just kind of shocked that this opportunity came to me, you know, as I turned 63 this past July. Like, you go, okay, well, you know, how many people on the planet Earth are getting this kind of opportunity at this stage in their lives?
Yeah.
Not too many.
That's
know?
Great.
So I felt really kind of lucky and blessed that was what was going on. So
that's cool. So, how would you, because I haven't heard the record yet and I'm really looking forward to it. How would you explain it to somebody who hasn't heard it yet? Is it a rock record or is it a pop rock record? What would you?
No, it's a rock record through and through. Like, yeah. I mean, you can imagine Life's in a Rush and LaBrie of Dream Theater. There were certain things that were going right in that direction.
Yeah.
So, but there are songs. I mean, it's a Rick Emmett album. So, you know, for a guy like you, what does that conjure in your head? Are there songs of positivity? Yep.
Yeah.
Are there songs that sound like they wouldn't be out of place on an old Triumph album? Yes. Now, you know, for me, I would describe the record and say what I was trying to do was make a kind of an almost retro vintage vinyl album kind of rock record. So I was going right back to my roots, like what kind of guitar playing did Clapton do in the Blues Breakers, and what kind of guitar playing did Jeff Beck do on the Truth album, and what kind of guitar playing did Jimmy Page do on Since I've Been Loving You on Zeppelin 3, you know, like those kinds of things. I was going, that's the kind of rock record, you know, I'd like to try and sort of shoot for. So I picked songs, and I had lots to choose from, that would sort of lend themselves to that kind of a vibe. Now, having said that, I've mentioned all British guitar players, but song-wise, I had songs that were kind of like, you know, this is a little bit like Atlanta Rhythm Section, or, geez, you know, this song sounds like Hendrix is sitting in with the band and Levon Helm is the drummer, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an American Southern kind of bluesiness to some of the stuff that's, I think, maybe right at the heart of the record, you know. Like when it gets to its most serious, you know, tracks, I don't know, 4, 5, 6 in the 11 tracks, you know, I think, well, that's where that Southern American rock kind of thing belongs. You know, we'll get all the yayas out of the way, then we'll get to that serious heart of the matter shit, and then, you know, we'll get the guests playing on a big epic thing at the end, and then, P.S., here's the guys from Triumph playing on a weird little jazz ballad. You know, so, you know, you described me as eclectic. I think people are going to listen to the record, and like when I delivered to the record company, they went, wow, this is so eclectic, like in a good way. You know, we can't pigeonhole it, like stylistically. And I go, well, that's because you left me up to my own devices, and so that's what you're going to get, you know.
Yeah, right. Be careful what you ask for.
Yeah.
So, but from what you're telling me, it sounds a little bit like there's heft. There's some real heft to the record.
It's a quartet at heart.
Yeah.
And it's the same guys I take live on the road. Dave Dunlop on guitar, Steve Skingley on bass, and Paul DeLong on drums.
Mm-hmm.
And like they're all world class kind of players. But Dave and Steve have worked really hard over the last 20 years of their lives to become sort of record producers and engineers. And so, in a way, I sort of hired them and said, okay, you guys produce. So the band, in a very insular way, was, you know, responsible for what it was. We rehearsed, you know, we could have cut plenty of the stuff live off the floor, but we did things where the drums were out on the studio floor and ambient mic'd, and, you know, Dave and I were sitting in the control room, you know, playing direct. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't quite live off the floor in that sense, but it's a real rock band kind of record. And then, you know, we got a friend of mine named Don Brightup came in to play keys on some things, and quite brilliantly, I might add. And, you know, I guess if I ever got hired to play some sort of gigantic outdoor show and I was going to have to recreate the album, I would have to see if I could get Don to come. I mean, he does a lot of film score and soundtrack work out of Los Angeles now, and he lives in Los Angeles, and the guy's won like a Grammy and that kind of stuff, so mm-hmm. Maybe not a Grammy. What's the one that's if you do TV?
That's the Emmy.
Emmy, yeah, that's it. He won an Emmy. Funny story about that one. He's going through the airport after he wins it, and he's got it in his bag, and he pulls it out and he shows it to the person, you know, it's at the
security
airline security,
yeah.
And he said, and he's, you know, quite sort of pumped up and proud of himself, and he goes, I guess you don't see many of these, and the guard looks him right in the eye and says, buddy, here we see all kinds of shit like this. I thought that was pretty good. Don't be so full of yourself.
Right, that deflated it.
Yeah.
So, when you're, I mean, and this is a vocal, mostly a vocal record, right? Or are there any instrumentals on this?
I'm sorry, say again?
This is mostly a vocal record, right? Are there many instrumentals on it?
Yeah, there's no instrumentals. Okay. Everything is a song. So I sing in every single one of them. And truthfully, like the A&R guy, Jim Potulski, he's sort of out of Pittsburgh. He said, oh, no, we want you to sing your ass off. You know, like, we want Rick Emmett. We want mm-hmm. we want the guy with the guy in Triumph, you know. That's so, yeah, it's all songs. But, you know, most of the songs are vehicles for old school kind of album rock kind of stuff, you
right.
know.
So live you can spread out and kind of take steer it around. Take it for a spin,
yep.
if you will.
Yes.
Yeah, that's cool. And so now, the will there be a tour?
Well, yeah, you know, sure. I mean, I tend to think of my life as the endless tour. You know, that, you know, when I get gigs on weekends, out I go. You know, and if I could string two weekends together in terms of the agent's brilliant routing, then okay, you know, now I have a 2 week. Section of the tour that never ends. But generally speaking, I'm sort of like a traveling salesman, you know. I go out and I play whatever gigs agents find for me that makes sense in terms of a paycheck, you know. I don't turn them down. I say, yeah, okay, I'll do it. You know, I only say no to the stuff that you know, they go, well, you know, it'll be good exposure. And I go, yeah, I don't need exposure. I'm an old guy now. So, find me paychecks, you know. I know what you're thinking. You're thinking in sort of the conventional way that, you know, an album comes out, and so now, you know, U2 plans their giant tour, and off they go out on tour, and they're on the road for 6 months, and then they take 4 weeks off, and then they go and do Australia, and then they take 2 weeks off, and then they go and do, you know, whatever, the Asian dates.
Right.
Like, I'm not U2, you know, and lots of bands in, you know, the music business try to pretend that their careers are at that size and stage, but they're not. There's very few bands that tour the way bands used to be able to tour back in the old days,
right.
you know. And I was never the kind of guy to be like a country guy that would say, yeah, I'm going to climb on my tour bus and I'll play anything. You know, mm-hmm. you find me a gas station at 2 o'clock in the morning where I can play and that'll pay for that day's gas. Yeah. Sure. I'll take that gig.
Right.
Like, I don't really think like that, you know?
Yeah.
So, yes, I'll tour. And because the label's European based, will they want us to get over to Europe? Yes, I would imagine they would.
Yeah, I would imagine so. Yeah.
And so it becomes a question of can my agency and can the record label figure out a way to make those things happen so that I can pay my sidemen in the style to which they've become accustomed. You know, like, yeah, I mean, I'm not a kid anymore, so I'm not going to go on tour where I have to, you know, get somebody who's a friend from my website to let me sleep on their couch.
Right.
You know, like,
oh God,
I'm not going to do that. No. You know,
like, oh my God, I can't even wrap my head around that.
Yeah, well, I never could. And in Truth and Triumph, when we first started, you know, the first band meetings, we'd sit there and the guys would say, the first thing we're going to do is treat ourselves right. We're not going to, we're going to pay ourselves first. And it may not be a lot of money, but we're going to make sure we're getting a paycheck out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to, as soon as we can afford it, we're going to fly first class and we're going to stay in nice hotels because there's only three of us and there's no point in burning our candle at both ends.
Mm-hmm.
And we managed ourselves. So it was a high demand, high stress kind of situation. So touring was something where we went, you can't treat yourself badly. You got to eat right. You got to sleep right.
Yeah.
And the travel has to be as comfortable as you can possibly try to make it.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that was a survival technique, you know, more than anything. So, I mean, that's the way my life has been. That's the way I still look at it,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When will we see this record?
Well, I think they're going to start teasing in September. You know, there's all this stuff now that I don't really understand, like instant grat and iTunes and shit. So I think that starts in September with a track, and then another one in October and another one in November. And I think the hard, you know, so I'm guessing all of this is sort of like pre-release. Make your order now, kids. You know, like there'll be some sort of aspect of that. And mm-hmm. then since it went to the printer literally yesterday or today, my guess is they'll have product sometime around Halloween, maybe, you know,
okay.
The third week of October or something like that.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's great. I'm excited. I can't wait to hear it now. I'm really looking forward to it.
Thank you.
Before we went on air, you and I were chatting, and you had mentioned that you had some Leslie West stories. You and I were talking about Leslie and how wonderful he is.
Yeah.
You want to share those?
Of course I do, yeah.
Okay.
So I did not know Leslie, and I hadn't met him until I did a NAMM show where Dean Guitars was doing the reissue of the Flying V, the white Flying Vs that I used 1981.
Mm-hmm.
On the Allied Forces tour. So I go to the NAMM show in Los Angeles, and he's got and this guy Dean Zielinski, he had Rudy Schenker in the booth. He'd flown him in, and he had Leslie West. He was doing a Leslie West reissue or something. So I get to meet him and talk to him and stuff, and so this is in January, and now I live in Canada. So when you're leaving your house to go to Los Angeles, there's snow on the ground. It's freezing cold, right? And but I figured out that if I wear sort of a three-piece suit and I throw a scarf around my neck, then I don't have to necessarily take my winter coat and shit. I can climb in the taxi and get to the airport, and then, you know, take the scarf off, and I'm good.
Mm-hmm.
So, but on the day that I'm leaving L.A. to come back home, I've got the three-piece suit on again, and I come in the hotel, you know, they have the breakfast, buffet, so down to the lobby for the breakfast buffet, and here's all these guitar player guys in various stages of recovering from their nights before, hanging around the bacon and eggs. And Leslie's sitting there, and you've interviewed Leslie, so you know he's got a voice that's kind of like, it's really gravelly, and it's really low.
Yeah. Ooh, nailed it.
Sounds like he's been smoking cigars, gargling fucking brandy. So he's sitting there, and Leslie's—he's a bit of a cracker. Like he doesn't mind making jokes and
he's a straight shooter.
Making fun of people. Yeah. So he looks at me and he says, "Oh my God, Emmett, you look like my accountant." Because I'm wearing the suit, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I stand there, and it's kind of like, it took me right back to, like, high school lunchroom, where you've walked into the lunchroom, and one of the guys is taking a shot at you, right? And it's like, ooh, all the other guys around the table kind of go a little quiet, because, ooh, you just took a shot at him, what's going to happen? And I look at him, I say, well, I don't know, Leslie. I've done pretty good with my money. Do you want any advice with yours? Have you got any left? To which everybody at the table kind of goes like, oh, oh, burned. Leslie's burned. Because the poor guy, he burned through his money in a couple of marriages. And, he's got nothing left, right? So, and I didn't do it on purpose. It was just, it was my 16-year-old high school kid coming out of me, so I burned him. So, anyways, I like him. We're good pals. We exchange phone numbers, and then this is the corollary in the second story. 6 months later, my phone rings, right? And I pick it up, and a guy goes, "Hey, Rick. I need an appointment right away. I gotta talk to you." And I go, "Leslie West, is that Leslie?" He goes, "Yeah, I got a bad tooth." I go, "Leslie, I'm not sure what's happening here, but I think maybe you think you're calling your dentist, but this is Rick Emmett." And he goes, "Ah, fuck." "I got a couple of Ricks in my phone. Okay, fuck off. I gotta go." And that was it. And that's the last I heard of Leslie West.
Oh, my God.
He had a bad tooth, and he called me.
That's so funny. That is fantastic. When I was talking to him, I told him that my band had opened for him in the 80s. And I told him, he saw what dressing room they had us in, and we were basically in a closet. And he took pity on us, and he gave us food from his craft services and everything else. And he goes, "I did?" I go, "Yeah." He goes, "Doesn't sound like me."
You got to work on your Leslie impression.
Yeah, no, I don't have it down.
You got to go down here.
Got to go like this. Okay, like this.
He always sounds like he's gargled, Drano. The first time I met him, Mountain was opening for Triumph, and it was like one of the backstage things. I think it was in New Jersey, maybe, at the Meadowlands. And he comes up to me. He goes, "I got a present for you." And he gives me a guitar knob that goes to 11. Now, and at the time, these were not... it was the first time I'd ever seen it. Like, everybody knew the Spinal Tap joke.
Right.
These amps, they go to 11. And DiMarzio, he had an endorsement relationship with DiMarzio, so I guess they gave him a bunch of these knobs that they'd made that went to 11. And so he would just kind of go around, and in the same way you might give out a guitar pick with your name on it or something, he was giving out knobs that went to 11. So it's like... it made him memorable, right?
Oh,
like, I go, fuck, I'll never forget the time I met Leslie West and he gave me a knob that went to 11.
He's a character. Yeah. I love him.
What a character,
yeah.
Eh?
I had another question I wanted to ask you about, I really love the 10 Invitations record. It's such a beautiful record. Now, with the tunes on there, I had talked to Pat Metheny about this, and I asked him, I said, you know, when you're titling songs, I said, and it's instrumental music, obviously, is it hard for you to come up with a title, or does the music influence the title, or vice versa? And he said that he wished that he didn't have to title music at all, and that people could just, you know, decide what it made them feel like, and they could put their own titles on it.
Right.
You know, and there's a track on there that really moves me, and it's called Castle of Regret.
Right.
And so how has that worked with you in regards to titles?
Well, let me digress just a touch, because, I just want to say Pat Metheny is one of my favorite guitar players on the planet Earth.
Me too.
And I think he's one of the greatest guitar artists we've had in our lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when he speaks, you know, I take that pretty seriously, because we don't have a lot of heroes as we get older, but, you know, Metheny has always been one of my guitar heroes.
Yeah, me too.
And I think he comes up with some pretty good titles, but the idea of having to try and take something that's metaphorical and poetic and then trying to make it so that it becomes accessible to an audience, you know, yes, you're now sort of narrowing in and making your own interpretation of something that it would be far nicer. I mean, that point that he made to you about titles, I hated, and I mean hated, when MTV made it so that there was going to be this literal visual story that was going to happen as your song played.
Mm.
And now the song was not going to be in somebody's imagination where they were able to come up with their own stories and stuff. As soon as you put, you know, a guy in a red hat doing something when the chorus hits, that's what people are going to associate that with, because, you know, you're going to rob them of their own imagination,
yeah.
Which, you know, I hated that originally.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, then you go, well, it's the way of the world. You know, that's what's happening. There's no way around it. So I'll have to go with it. So the titling of instrumental things, you know, there's kind of no way around it. You could give it a number, I suppose, you know, but, you know, in that sense, I kind of feel like, nah, you know, like, there's, and I get maybe part of it is, like, Pat's not a guy that writes songs per se and writes lyrics and you know, has a much more, you know, literal kind of thread, which is not to say that he doesn't have, you know, incredibly strong compositional threads. You know, he's got a point. He's always got a point,
mm-hmm.
you know. But that the one that you're asking me about in particular, that title came after. And part of it is, that, you know, that song, it's in D minor. I'm not sure if that's the saddest of all keys, but...
Mm, that's pretty close.
Certainly, yeah, and I think that, isn't there a line in Spinal Tap where the guy sits at the piano and...
Yeah.
Yeah, and the guy asks him, and he goes, "Well, it's in." Maybe he says B minor. Maybe I can't remember what key he says. He says, "Oh, it's in D minor, the saddest of all keys, really."
Yeah.
He goes, "It's quite beautiful. What's it called?" He goes, "Lick My Love Pump." Anyhow, another tangent, another digression. Yeah, so it's in D minor, and that piece, Castle of Regret. And, I mean, here's the way I came up with the title. It, for sure, I was channeling and sort of being inspired by pieces by Soar and Torrega that I'd heard from a Segovia album, like back in my youth.
Mm-hmm.
And so those were pretty informative and very, very Spanish kinds of constructions. So I'm writing my own little piece here, and I'm realizing that I'm, you know, probably cribbing some shit, and I'm going, you know, well, we'd gone on a tour in England, my wife and I, where we'd gone to see a lot of castles, and, you know, some have been restored, and, you know, in some cases, nobility or the, you know, the generations of nobility have, you know, maintained them as residences and, you know, use them as tourist attractions. And in some circumstances, there's just a pile of rocks up on the top of a hill somewhere, and, you know, there's nothing there except the wind and ghosts, and you kind of go, ooh, you know, this is a little weird and spooky. And but, of course, you're looking at this ruined castle, and it takes you back to you think about when it was a bustling, thriving, you know, edifice of humanity. There probably was a marketplace in the courtyard. There, you know, there would have been people coming and going, and guards up on the ramparts, and, you know, all this stuff. But now it's nothing but a heap of rock, you know. And so you go, wow, you know, this is what life is like. This is what happens, you know, like ashes to ashes, dust to dust. So I was, that was the thinking in my head, that I was thinking, well, you know, this is such a sad kind of piece of music, but it's ornate and it has a lot of architecture to it. It's kind of like, you know, a castle that has, you know, fallen into disrepair, and, you know, there's a lot of sadness here. You know, maybe, you know, people died, and, you know, they grew old and they died, or they got a disease and died, or, you know, the king and the queen, you know, she died, and now he's died, heart of sadness. And so I'm going, okay, well, I don't have to be too specific. All I need to do is be able to kind of say, castle of something. And, you know, there's been, Hendrix had castles made of sand or whatever it was, and there's castles that float in the air. And so the idea of castles is not so far-fetched in terms of an imaginative kind of construct. So then I just thought, well, it feels like regret, you know, like it feels like a sadness that's more a regret than a melancholy or a grief. It's like the, so I go, okay, castles of regret, you know. I didn't make it plural. I think I made it singular.
Yeah, you did.
But, castles, you know, I suppose I could have written a series of pieces, and then all of set in minor keys. They could have been the castles.
That would be great.
I only had one, so only a castle of regret.
That's great.
The D minor castle.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I hear what Pat is saying, and honestly, that guy is, he's such an unbelievable artist. When I listen to, there's a piece of his on an album called First Circle called If I Could. And it's one of my favorite things.
Yeah.
And again, that title, it suggests regret. You know, if I could only speak to her one more time, if I could only, you know. So, and I, that's one of the things, I think one of the things that Pat does so well are those kinds of feelings of melancholy, longing.
Yeah.
You know, he seems to be able to just find melodies and constructions that and they speak to me. And so, I was once at a Pat Metheny concert, and he was playing one of his more joyous things with the band, Pat Metheny Group. And I turned, and there was a woman sitting beside me, and she was crying like she was at a funeral. Like, whatever his music meant to her, she was, you know, like regretting breaking up with a boyfriend, or this was the music that she shared with somebody in her family who had died, or, man, she was just, you know, exactly the opposite place from everybody else in the house. But he has that ability, man, to touch people right in that.
Oh yeah, the first time I ever heard "Are You Going With Me" from the Off Ramp record, I couldn't believe it was happening. I mean, I was in my room and I had the record on and I was like, it was just washing over me. It was incredible.
Yeah.
Much in the same way. The first time I ever heard Ralph Towner play a track called Spirit Lake. Holy
cow. What album is that on?
That's on it's called Solo. It's a live disc from him. Just him on a guitar on stage in Munich.
12-string guitar?
12-string guitar.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
I'll track that down.
Oh, it's a good one.
I love it when I do interviews like this and then, you know, people tell me about something that I've never heard and I go, okay, track that down.
Yeah, and the album cover is great. It took me a long time to figure out what it was, but it's a burnt matchbook and there's one match left in there, but it's burnt. But there's one match still left in the matchbook. It's such a great album.
Wow.
Wonderful. Wonderful.
Okay, I'll check that out.
Well, Rick, I got to tell you, it was amazing to talk to you, and I can't thank you enough for being on Guitar Radio Show.
Oh, you're welcome. My pleasure.
And please, you know, let us know when that record comes out. We want to hear it, and we want to turn people onto it here on all of our affiliates and through all of our social media as well.
Great. Appreciate that.
Well, thanks so much. Hold on one second, but we're going to sign off right here.
Okay.
Thanks.
Well, there you have it, folks. Is he great or what? Such a great guitar player. And man, he sings just as good as he did 40 years ago. It's unbelievable. He's so talented, man. And so gracious and really wonderful to talk to. It was a blast. Thank you, Rick. And I hope you enjoyed it as much as we did. Folks, I want to remind you, don't forget about this giveaway that we're doing of the Checkered Pedals Phaser. Go to guitarradioshow@gmail.com, put in the subject line, give me that pedal. You're automatically entered to win. And the last day for that is November 1st, 2016. So don't wait. Get on it. And folks, also want to remind you, we've got some really cool stuff coming from DNA Guitars very, very soon, our sponsor here at Guitar Radio Show. And we're really thrilled to share all the new stuff that's coming from them. Very exciting news that's coming from this company that is really starting to take on the Nashville scene by storm. It's pretty incredible. The Nashville scene is just really starting to go crazy over these guitars. So, you know, that's what happens. It's like Nashville, Austin, L.A., you know, those places are feeding grounds for something that's going to eventually become nationwide and eventually worldwide. So I think you're going to be pretty interested when you hear about some of the cool stuff over at DNA Guitars. Go to dnaguitarcompany.com for more, and November is going to be super cool. Anyway, we got to get out of here. In the meantime, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, keep on playing, and please buy it. Don't steal it, and we'll see you on the next episode of Guitar Radio Show. Peace!
Now everybody say, F you, Ed!
I like this crowd already.
GRS Productions.
New episodes of Guitar Radio Show air every Wednesday on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Podbay, Player FM, Podomatic, and of course on GuitarRadioShow.com.